This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Beyond the G7, the dollars and cents of globalization and trade, a view from the left. Lori Wallach, director, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, whose books include The Rise and Fall of Fast Track Trade Authority, Whose Trade Organization, a comprehensive guide to the WTO. And recently, Wallach was one of three panelists alongside Chancellor Angela Merkel at the C20 summit titled Civil 20 Dialogue with the G20 Presidency, which addressed the most pressing globalization challenges of the 2017 G20 summit. Lori Wallach, it is an absolute pleasure to have you back with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to go back to 2016 to set the context for the rest of our discussion. And that was when we were looking at the issue of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and many of us were fighting mightily against that. And the issue of NAFTA was still very prevalent. Many folks were very antagonistic to it, as well they should be, particularly in the working class here. And the election, which some people feel catapulted Trump ahead by virtue of having a position that would seem to be counter to certainly the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. Give us the kind of trajectory of issues and their real import for the working class on these issues since the 2016 election.
President Trump, as a candidate, promised a lot of very big changes, appropriating what had been a critique coming from labor unions and progressive groups like Public Citizen and largely Democrats in Congress, but some of what I would call the Main Street Republicans, the guys who actually stand with labor sometimes and stand with the small businesses, not the guys just flocking for the big multinationals. That critique and as well specific policy demands for changes in policies and trade agreements to change those outcomes, that whole agenda was largely appropriated by Trump. Bernie Sanders was running on a similar set of critiques and a slightly different than Trump set of solutions. Bernie's more internationalist and Trump's more nationalist. Ultimately, they boiled down to getting rid of the incentives now at the heart of trade agreements like NAFTA to outsource jobs, the rules that absent any floor of labor standards, wage standards, toxics rules, environmental standards, incentivize U.S. companies to relocate production to Mexico to pay very low wages and dump toxics and then bring the products back to the U.S. for sale. In addition, both Sanders, with a more internationalist view of it, and Trump, with a more nationalist view, had policies to try and deal with what I would call our second big set of trade problems. We have trade agreements that have been big job killers, and we have a trade policy with respect to China that has led to enormous trade deficits. And even by the supporters of the trade status quo, an admission of several million, perhaps up to 3 million U.S. manufacturing jobs lost. Under NAFTA, the U.S. government has certified almost 1 million industrial jobs lost. So the critique was there, and then what's happened since? Trump has flip-flopped on most of his China-related trade promises. He promised he would declare China a currency violator, a manipulator, and the first day in office and quickly get that trade balance in order. In fact, in Trump's first 18 months, the China trade deficit has steadily grown. Trade deficit for the first 4 months of 2018 is the highest on record for the first 4 months of any month. Not only did Trump not do anything about China and the currency issues, but he has been going all over the place back and forth on what his China trade policy will be. They did launch about a month ago a big trade enforcement case aimed at one prong of what correctly is part of the underlying problem with our China trade policies, which is we're kind of playing by these rules the corporations in the U.S. wrote that are kind of vaguely somewhat capitalistic slash managed trade. And the Chinese government is running a set of trade policies that are very much not with those rules and are with the government, basically heavily involved in sort of a strategic, both military and economic agenda that includes big subsidies and forced technology transfer from the U.S., and dumping of excess product and buying up U.S. companies that would be competitors in strategic sort of industries of the future, like robotics and other sectors, driverless cars, and then taking out the technology and getting rid of the domestic companies to get rid of the competition. It's pretty predatory behavior. And the administration launched an effort to do something about that. But then, 2 weeks later, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, he formerly of a big Wall Street firm, decided he was putting that on hold and that instead we'd just sell some more soy and airplanes and liquid natural gas to China and everything would be fine. People calm down. Don't go at the structural issues. And then a week after that, the president flip-flopped back. And in the middle of that, the president, seemingly for his own business interests, caved in on basically a deal to stop a Chinese company that was seen as a security risk, ZTE, the phone company. The phones were banned on U.S. military bases because they were seen as spying devices. Plus, the company was up for $1 billion in sanctions for selling phones to Iran and North Korea that could be used as spying devices. And the company was about to get shut down under these sanctions. And then the president dove in to save it. And then, you know, funny thing. $500 million loan went to a resort development in Indonesia where there were Trump properties that were struggling. So they're all over on China. The good news is NAFTA. Actually, they're heading in the right direction on replacing NAFTA. And we can talk more about the details, but here's a shocker. If you guys are holding up hot coffee, now's the time to put it down. The administration has insisted on eliminating investor-state dispute settlement, those outrageous corporate privileges that make it easier and safer to outsource jobs and that empower multinational corporations to attack our domestic laws in front of tribunals of three corporate attorneys who can order unlimited sums of taxpayer money if a foreign company, a multinational, thinks that a domestic law for the environment or a safety regulation or a court ruling undermines the new NAFTA privileges. Well, the Trump administration put down their foot and said that needs to come out. And they've been so firm about it that Mexico and Canada have basically agreed. And that was one of the core things in the TPP for all folks fighting across the country. These are those outrageous tribunals and investor rights. Mm. They first started in NAFTA. They were getting even beefier in the TPP. Well, this NAFTA renegotiation looks to take those out. Plus, there are a handful of other things that are exactly the things progressives have been demanding for decades that, coincidentally, you want to change the outcomes in NAFTA, you don't have anything else you can do. You got to change this stuff. So they're pushing some of the right stuff. And even on wages and labor standards, is not totally bleak to be discussed.
Laura, I definitely want to get back to NAFTA later on, but I want to talk about tariffs. When Trump first took over, the main concern was this case in Indiana on the ball bearing plant where the jobs were being outsourced. And that was talked about a lot in other outsourcing. But now it seems to be tariffs, 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 as we've seen at the recent G7s. Can you tell us your takeaway from what was happening at the G7 and what wasn't discussed at the G7, which was most of the issues that you talked about so far.
The G7 situation is one that I find extremely peculiar. Most of the G7 leaders have worked to build warm relationships with Trump, despite his xenophobia, racism, misogyny, climate denialism, warmongering, and even corrupt business self-dealing. But that ended at this G7. He got welcomed like a rabid skunk to the picnic. Why? None of those previous sins was enough. No! The man took on the trade status quo, a bridge too far for the G7 leaders. Now, I'm being melodramatic about it, but it really annoys me. It's a bitter irony because trade and financial policies that the G7 leaders have relentlessly promoted really created the political context that helped to make Trump president with all of the attending woe. There have been decades of U.S. presidents, Democrats and Republicans alike, and their G7 counterparts who have pushed international economic policies that have created expansive new rights and powers for multinational companies and hurt working people, not just in the U.S., not just in Europe, but around the world. So the agenda G7 for decades has been pushing corporate rig trade agreements, blessing financial deregulation, and loosening trillions in speculative investment flows. Meanwhile, even as millions of manufacturing jobs were lost, most notably here but in other countries as well, there was no coordinated G7 action to counter China's currency manipulation. There was no unified approach to end the subsidies in China and other unfair practices that, among other things, led to the huge global steel and aluminum oversupply glut, which then loops us back to these damn tariffs. Because the tariffs are a tool that are supposed to try and fix this aluminum and steel oversupply. The tariffs are not supposed to be a permanent feature of the landscape. The tariffs were threatened, and a bunch of countries basically took one of six possible steps, the goal of which was to shut down markets for the subsidized oversupply of Chinese steel and aluminum. Brazil, Australia, Korea, different countries figured out either, hey, we're not sending you that stuff. We're not shipping it through our country to you. We're not buying that stuff. You don't have to worry about us. We get an exception. Or, all right, we are buying some of that stuff, so we agree to send you one-third less of it than we would otherwise. Or we are selling you that stuff, and we're going to continue to, so I guess we'll just have to take the tariffs on the aluminum. But on steel, totally kosher. We're not doing that. Other countries negotiated settlements. It's unclear to me, as a sort of recovering trade attorney, why Europe and Canada didn't negotiate a deal, or Mexico for that matter. All those parties thought they weren't ever going to get sanctioned, despite clearly being part of the issue. You know, no one claims Canada is a security threat. The statute under which this was done has to do with the potential security threat if the U.S. has no source of aluminum or steel that is reliable either for our domestic infrastructure or for military defense. So we are right now down to, they've all the rest have been run out of business, one aluminum plant that makes aircraft-grade aluminum. This was the study that was done before these tariffs were threatened, and then a lot of countries negotiated terms. But some countries didn't, and those are the tariffs. And the countries that got the tariffs are really upset about it, understandably. Some of them have counter-sanctioned, so it's called retaliation. And the question is, will the countries all keep their eyes on the goal, which is to counter this oversupply? They've been talking about this in different international fora for 4 years, haven't done anything. And the U.S. has absorbed the brunt of it, which has been okay with the other G7 countries as long as it wasn't landing in their laps. But now that we're putting up those tariffs, all that extra supply is going to start to float around other places, which probably is making the other countries as mad as the tariffs. The problem with all of this is that Trump himself is so nasty, disrespectful, vindictive, personal, that instead of being able to have a constructive discussion of, ladies and gentlemen of the G7, we have a mutual problem. We're getting flooded with Chinese aluminum and steel. We spent 4 years talking with you. Then we spent 4 months telling you we're going to put up sanctions if this didn't get fixed. Let us work together to fix the problem. That's the way to avoid. No. That's not the kind of discussion. Instead, it became very personal, and that's not constructive.
Lori, you have been dubbed the trade debate's guerrilla warrior in a National Journal profile and the Ralph Nader with a sense of humor in a Wall Street Journal profile. But you are making my head spin because I want to be grounded firmly and rooted against anything and everything that is part of Agent Orange, i.e. Donald Trump. But you are actually taking me in a direction that is very troubling to perhaps a very doctrinaire politic, and that is I must be dismissive of, or worse, defeat anything and everything that is Donald Trump. So how am I supposed to understand these things? Are we talking about protectionism? Are we talking about isolationism? What do we really mean about trade wars? And are you taking me in the direction of saying that but for the bitterness and the egomaniacal personality and behavior of Trump, that these policies are actually advantageous to the working class? Oh, help me out on this one. I'm looking for guidance.
It's head spinning. I pulled out Alice in Wonderland just to try and get a sense of Alice going down the rabbit hole to get some perspective. The reality is that in trade politics, it's not so much left and right. You have Democrats and Republicans who have a view of what trade and globalization policy should be, and most of it's actually not even about trade. Most of it's new investor rights and the investor state tribunals and deregulating finance. It has nothing to do with actual trade. There's a view that Republicans and Democrats of that corporate view have basically identical views of how it should go. And then there is a view that is from the left, a worker-centered, people and planet-centered view. And from the right is a sort of small business and national interest, nationalistic, what's good for the nation, the United States view. And there is probably about a 70% overlap in what the policy changes and concerns are with the people who do not take the corporatist view on trade. It does not matter if you are a super conservative or you are a super lefty. For different reasons, you don't like investor state dispute settlement. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts of the Supreme Court laid out the threat it poses to our sovereignty. The National Conference of State Legislatures, dominated by Republicans, has taken a position of opposing any trade agreement that has investor state dispute settlement. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Professor Stiglitz, Professor Tribe, icons of progressive thinking, have also said they'll oppose any trade agreement that has ISDS. It's a democracy issue. It's a corporate power issue. But in either instance, if you want to be as kind as possible, it boils down to undermining people's power and democracy in favor of these extra judicial bodies. When it comes, for instance, to one of the issues where you would not expect any official of the Trump administration to do the right thing, but the chief trade negotiator is a guy who has worked with unions, worked in the steel manufacturing sector for years. He is advocating for labor and environmental standards for NAFTA. We'll see if they end up getting the kind of standards that can get the support, say, of the unions. It's not done yet. They're actually fighting for improved standards, certainly relative to TPP, an agreement negotiated, yes, by a Democrat. This is where you see that line where it's not really Democrats versus Republicans. It is corporatist versus not. From the conservative perspective, low wages in Mexico, the dumping of toxics there, is seen as what they call social dumping, basically externalizing costs of production. It's a subsidy promoting companies to go to Mexico for all the wrong reasons, not because there's some natural advantage, not because there's some particular reason, but rather because you can externalize costs that should be on the company. From a progressive perspective, obviously, labor rights and environmental rights are basic human rights. We believe as a matter of principle that there is a universal right to have a healthy environment. We need to keep our planet alive and well and combat climate chaos. We believe labor rights are universal rights. Doesn't really matter where you're coming to it. If you demand on having environmental and labor rights in a trade agreement and condition the terms of the agreement on it, that is a good development. There are a bunch of issues. NAFTA has a ban on buy local and buy American and buy New York, where you can't have local preferences to allow our tax dollars to get recycled into our economies. So from a progressive perspective, that's a problem with buy local. And that's a problem about building local economies, and that's a problem about having long-distance shipping and what it does to the climate, and not allowing communities to set preferences for the kind of, do they want sweat-free purchases, do they want a living wage? We see that from that perspective. From a more conservative perspective, they think of the Buy America laws from since the Great Depression as building a strong military industrial base that is part of the strength of the country. There are a variety of issues that are at the core of changing NAFTA, where there is a peculiar left-right consensus. That is different and has been there all along, separate from Trump. The reason why the fact that Trump has any common position from where all of us have been, we've all been against NAFTA since before there was NAFTA. We could foresee what would happen. Trump was against NAFTA from way back when. His vision of what to do about it has that overlap, but then it goes very wrong. He then conflates the real issues, like the corporate outsourcing protections, with bashing Mexicans, being anti-Mexico. We see the fact that the agreement was written by elites in all three countries. In the U.S., there were 600 official corporate advisors who got to help write NAFTA, just like TPP. It's the same system. And we saw in Mexico, in Canada, the companies calling the shots. I mean, the campesinos, the small farmers in the southern part of Mexico were just destroyed by NAFTA. This was not in their interest. Real wages in Mexico now are lower than before NAFTA. No labor rights, no protections for workers, the elite basically having a system to cap independent unions. That's what you get. As we think about this moment, it is really too bad it is not President Sanders and a U.S. trade representative for one of the labor unions, because they would probably have that same 70% of the NAFTA fix. The other 30% would be very different, very internationalist, very progressive. For instance, Trump is pushing for new monopoly patent rights for big pharmaceutical companies in NAFTA that could raise medicine prices, versus if you had a really progressive Democrat, you would probably have some system of universal health care in the trade agreement. With respect to China, you might have a President Sanders using these same tariff tools. Tariff's just a tool if you use it strategically. If you bonk someone upside the head with it, with no demand, with no vision, with no goal, then a tariff becomes a weapon and you can get into a war. A tariff otherwise is a tool. Actually, it's very cynical. The mainstream media doesn't cover a lot of so-called trade wars and tariffs. Oh, my God! When they're threatened regularly against countries for not following corporate patent rights. We threaten tariffs, the U.S. does, all the time. It's bad, because countries are making generic versions of medicines and big pharma's upset. Don't see hysterical coverage about that. The hysteria about the tariffs now is because they're being threatened to try and save working class jobs. And that apparently deserves less favorable coverage.
Lori, it seems as if everybody's thinking of countries against countries. Can you also look at it as multinational corporations against workers of the world?
In the context of NAFTA, that's what I was describing. That's a difference between us and Trump. Trump looks at it nationalistically. The U.S. is getting ripped off. And we look at it and say, no. These corporate elite in the three countries got together and they wrote their playbook. And we've all gotten stuffed. Canada has paid over $200 million in the investor state sanctions, Canadian taxpayers, to foreign corporations. The U.S. has lost 1 million manufacturing jobs and real wages are flat. Mexico has seen 2 million campesino farmers thrown off their land, and wages are down in their industrial sector. This has not been a win for working people in any three of the countries, and the kind of fixes that, strange though it seems, are actually being pushed right now. And you can get involved. Go to Public Citizens' lefty campaign on the issue, www.replacenafta, one word, replacenafta.org, www.replacenafta.org. Because it tells you what you can do and also the state of the negotiations where taking out the investor state dispute settlement rights is really happening. And getting rid of the Buy America ban, maybe adding labor standards. That's the part we still need to fight on. Wage standards are being discussed. But also, when it comes to China, that is the one thing that is different. Generally, it is true. It is corporations against workers of the world. Certainly, the way the WTO played out has been that way. But with respect to China, when you have a government that is the private sector, that is the corporate sector, that is the military, that is the government, all rolled into one, and there's centralized planning of that government with respect to how, for instance, the China 2025 industrial strategy to dominate industries of the future relates to various military ambitions, relates to various territorial fights, to various diplomatic goals. It is a unified state power through trade and industry that is really distinct from any of our other trade partners, and so it's a different set of problems.
What is a view from the left? How do we situate ourselves, encapsulate all of this for us?
We need to, in this horrific Trump administration, see if we can jiu-jitsu out any single one piece of progress. And it may be that replacing NAFTA is that. There is an opportunity, improbable though it is, for a variety of peculiar political reasons, to get a NAFTA replacement. It ain't done, but the odds are certainly better of winning on this than they were when we started the TPP fight and we all won that together.
Mm-hmm.
There is an opportunity to get a NAFTA replacement that sets the model of a different kind of trade agreement, the demands we've all been pushing for decades. It seems improbable. Go to www.replacenafta.org to hear more of the details. If we do the work right, the kind of agreement that we could get without ISDS would send a signal to the whole rest of the world that even here in the belly of the beast, we have actually taken a turn on these trade rules. And if that's the only good thing that happens, which is a NAFTA without investor-state dispute settlement, with labor standards, with some wage standards, without the ban on buy local, buy America, another thing that's being discussed is what's called a sunset clause. So the agreement would terminate every 5 years unless we authorize, so it would inject some accountability and democracy. If we were able to achieve that almost by accident for a variety of peculiar circumstances, that may be the only thing that is not just downright dreadful that happens in this administration. And it's only going to be good if we all fight to actually get the outcome we want.
And we're going to leave it there, but only for this moment, because all of us are going to continue to follow Lori Wallach's words and actions and policies. She is the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and you need to keep an eye on Global Trade Watch from Public Citizen to get the real skinny on all of these issues. Thank you for parsing out for us these enormously complex issues and giving us some of the nuances. And maybe I'll feel a little bit better because politics should be nuanced. Guess I have to be a little bit less doctrinaire. Lori.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. And let me just say, it is Pepto-Bismol swigging inducing to have to think about Trump associated with any of this stuff. We all just need to think about what have been our demands over the last number of decades, and let's see if we can win any of them. Let's not think about the circumstances of how, once we are able to fix these problems in the trade agenda, we have to face all the other horrific damage that we're not able to deal with this administration.
Lori Wallach, thank you for your wise comments, and we will make that so.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.